Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You will receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here's a special offer to my podcast listeners. If you join the Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com and sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, I'll send you a free, personally autographed copy of my book, Gettysburg, and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com. Use the code FREEBOOK at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com, code FREEBOOK. This offer ends January 31st. On this episode of Newt's World, this Monday, January 27th, is the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, one of the most extraordinary events of our time. There's an International Day of Remembrance because Auschwitz was so horrifying and so difficult for people just to comprehend. Auschwitz itself was liberated by our allies, the Russians, at the end of World War II. There were 7,000 survivors of Auschwitz when it was liberated, but an estimated 1.1 million people died or were killed at Auschwitz. These 7,000 survivors have descendants alive today telling the story of this terrible genocide. You know, around the world, many people have no idea what happened in Nazi Germany. They have no idea about the nature of evil and what it can do to people. But I believe, on the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, that this is a very important and useful time for us to stop, take a deep breath, look evil in the face, be reminded every time we see anti-Semitism now that the time to stop it is now, before it grows into something that's unstoppable. As Americans, I think we have an obligation to our fellow humans to not have that kind of hatred. You know, the United States was founded by people who believed in religious liberty. And I think that we have to uphold that belief in religious liberty, and that includes protecting those who would be destroyed simply because of their belief or simply because of their genetic background. So I think today is an extraordinary time, and I'm particularly glad that we have a very knowledgeable guest, Mr. Fred Zeidman, who is the Chairman Emeritus of the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. The International Holocaust Remembrance Day is really important because it doesn't just talk about the liberation of Auschwitz, which happened on January 27, 1945. And Auschwitz was a symbol of a horrible series of death camps, which were part of a methodical effort by the Nazis to literally eliminate every person who had Jewish blood. I think it's important to understand that behind this terrible evil at Auschwitz was the even greater evil across all of Europe, of a system which had grown up starting in the late 19th century when anti-Semitism became intellectually acceptable and you began to get people writing and blaming everything on the Jews. And as a result, people like Adolf Hitler suddenly found an explanation. Only Winston Churchill understood, because he'd actually read Mein Kampf, which was Hitler's book describing his beliefs. And he realized that this man was insane, but he was insane in a serious way, and given power would implement his insanity. Hitler built a remarkable movement. He was an extraordinarily powerful demagogic speaker. He was the leader, der Führer, and the result was that people were willing to do things because Hitler told them to do it that they would never have gotten around to doing on their own. And a key element of Hitler's entire belief system was destroying the Jews. Hitler gets to power in 1933 and immediately begins ordering anti-Jewish economic boycotts, staging book burnings, enacting discriminatory anti-Jewish legislation, so if you were a doctor who happened to be Jewish, you couldn't practice medicine. If you were a lawyer who happened to be Jewish, you couldn't practice the law. The 1935 Nuremberg Laws racially defined Jews by blood and led to really serious effort at tracking down, was your grandmother Jewish? In which case you were Jewish. And so you suddenly had a society that was amazingly paranoid and in which Hitler organized power brilliantly, partly because he had the lessons of Lenin and Stalin to draw on. He had the structure of the Soviet secret police, the NKVD. The Gestapo essentially was modeled on the Soviets. And Hitler understood that it would work, that if you terrified people on the one hand, but also made them feel remarkably heroic about themselves on the other, that you could build an emotional roller coaster in which people would conclude that it was better for you to go along and better for you to do what you wanted. And the result was he had very rapidly established a level of control. The Nazis unleashed what became known as Kristallnacht, November 9th, 1938. It was the first really clear example of just how vicious things were going to get. People didn't want to think about the good Germans going out here and attacking Jews, even though they had clear, visible evidence in 1938 that that's exactly what was starting to happen. Now, they had developed very early a concentration camp system. And the early concentration camps started with communists, socialists, opponents of Hitler, people who were gay, gypsies, people who had some kind of childhood problem. If you were born with autism or if you were born with Down syndrome, they methodically wanted to kill you. Now, this was actually part of a Western intellectual progressive model, which was that somehow if we could purify us of all of these people who were genetically inappropriate, everything would get better. And so there was this very intense effort to create a purified Germany. And ultimately, the real focus of that became the Jews. We have a chance now, you're going to hear from somebody who's devoted their life to sustaining an understanding of the Holocaust, Mr. Fred Zeidman, who is the Chairman Emeritus of the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. This is a great opportunity on Sunday to help educate people, and I'm really delighted that you are doing it, and I think your background is remarkable. You got involved and became ultimately Chairman Emeritus of the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. How did that happen, and why did you agree to do it?
I go way back with President Bush. And when he was elected president, I worked on his campaign. I chaired his Jewish outreach effort. And he asked me what I would like to do. And I said, there's only one job that I want. I'd like to be chairman of the United States Holocaust Museum. I want to make a difference. My entire life has been dedicated to Israel and the preservation of the Jewish people and the security of the Jewish people. And so I got that opportunity when he offered me single best job I could ever have. I really felt like it was time, as the survivor population was dwindling, and remember that was 18 years ago, that it was time to shift to a non-survivor. I was the first non-survivor to chair the museum, and I had the most phenomenal experience I could have ever even imagined working with the survivors and working to protect their legacy. And we did things like declare the genocide in Darfur. We recognized genocides as they were going forward. And to me, that's what we owed our survivors. You know, when you look at the statistics and you see the number of people that absolutely know nothing about the Holocaust, the numbers are staggering. There's only a third of the folks in the public school systems that have ever heard of the Holocaust. If you look at the anti-Semitism that's starting to become much, much more prevalent now, and you look at the killing of Jews because they're Jewish, today, you realize that the job of the Holocaust Museum becomes much, much more critical in informing people about what people can do.
So, Fred, let me ask you this. If a friend came to see you and they said, I'm taking my family to Washington next week, why should I take the time to go by the Holocaust Museum as opposed to all the other things I could do. What's the driving reason that they should go to the Holocaust Museum?
Mr. Speaker, that's a question I answer all the time. And I tell them that we have to know our history because history repeats itself. And you have to see the inhumanity of what man can do to man. Do we ever anticipate another Holocaust? No. But there's no better lesson that can be learned than going through the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Some of my most impactful days when I was there is to watch these young kids who are all saying, why am I doing this, walk into the museum. And then at the time they walk out, these are sixth and seventh graders from the Midwest who obviously had no experience with this, arguably for all intents and purposes. You know, this is not only a Jewish story. I mean, this is the story of man's inhumanity to man. And it's the only place that you can really see that lesson. You walk out of there and will never forget what you saw.
How can I forget? When we first came to Auschwitz, we were taken to an area where they shaved our heads, we were undressed, and given gray dresses, no underwear, just a gray dress, and wooden shoes. Then we were taken back to these barracks, on the way to the place where they shaved our heads and took our clothing. There was a big ditch where apparently people from the train who were too sick to move were put into these ditches with the dead, the living with the dead. And later on, they took these bodies and piled them up high. And they were just left there on a pile because they had no time to bury them. They had to take care of first other things. Anyway, our heads were shaven. We were given this great dress and we were taken back to the barracks. And every morning, about 4 o'clock, we went out to what was called a Zählappell, which they counted us, we were lined up, and they counted us. We stood there for several hours until somebody came and went through the whole camp counting. Then we would go back into our barracks.
You can't conceive what these folks went through.
Coming up, Auschwitz became the core symbol that ultimately worldwide was a symbol of a horrible series of death camps. When it comes to your estate planning, why not leave behind a lasting legacy that will also make a significant impact? After all, we can't take our money with us, but we can use it to improve the lives of the precious animals who call Delta Rescue home. Delta Rescue is the only no-kill care for life home for more than 1,500 dogs, cats, and horses. Founder Leo Grillo left a career in Hollywood to devote his life full-time to caring for these beautiful creatures. Delta Rescue is located on a 115-acre mountaintop ranch in Los Angeles, beautifully landscaped and surrounded by rolling hills. The perfect sanctuary for our lost furry friends. You know how I feel about animals. They are pure souls who only want to give love and get love unconditionally. What Leo Grillo is doing at Delta Rescue is beyond extraordinary, helping to save and care for these innocent creatures so they can live safely and in peace. For more information, go directly to deltarescue.org/newt and request our free estate planning package. That's deltarescue.org/newt. And, due to the overwhelming response over the holidays, the free movie, The Rescuer, is still featured on our website. It's an award-winning documentary about Leo's 2-year journey to rescue a family of 21 dogs abandoned in the wilderness. Stream it for free now. Go to deltarescue.org/newt today. Make it your New Year's resolution.
You look at the American soldiers and you see how they fought for democracy and they fought for freedom. And as they liberated the camps, it put a human touch on what they were doing that's just unsurpassable. I was on the World War II Museum board in New Orleans. And, you know, every day that I walked into that museum, the first thing you see is the picture of Dwight Eisenhower saying to his troops, take pictures, take every picture you possibly can. No one will ever believe what you're going to see. And, of course, the first camp that was liberated was Ardrift. And at the World War II Museum, we had a man come speak to us once. We had veterans that could still speak come to all of the board meetings. And we had one who actually had liberated Ardrift, and he was 95 years old. When it was over, I ran up to him, and I said, tell me what you knew when you went into that camp. I know what General Eisenhower said. What were you told? And he said, we were told that we were going to see something that none of us would ever believe, that it was indescribable, and there was no way to truly express what we were going to see until we got in and saw it. And he said, of course, all of us, when we got there, it was beyond anything any of us could have conceivably thought we would ever see.
One of the first ghastly sights to meet our eyes was a group of dead on the ground near the entrance. Now, these are part of the sick and the old, and they could no longer be useful to the Nazis, so they had them take them out of the barracks and they killed them before we arrived. In a shed nearby, there were more dead. They were piled up like cordwood. And over their bodies and between their bodies was a sprinkling of lime. I can tell you that it was a sight that I shall never forget. The reaction among all of us was to further steel our resolve to deal with these barbarians, because we consider the Nazis not as humans, but as devils in the flesh.
There were a number of death camps, including a number in Germany itself. Why do you think Auschwitz became the core symbol that ultimately worldwide, when we really think and talk about this, we come back to Auschwitz again and again? Why do you think that is?
It was the most intact camp. It started with it was right in the center of Poland. It was the largest camp. And they had the killing camp at Birkenau. Look, there were a lot worse. The first camp that I ever went to was Sachshausen, which was the first camp, and it was in Berlin. And now it's, you know, arguably not even a suburb of Berlin. It's within Greater Berlin. And I remember going to that, and you get off the train, and you walk down this little narrow path, and you see all these old folks that are still in the yard, and you wonder, what were they thinking? But at that camp, this is before they mastermind mass killing, and they were just, the people would walk into Sachshausen, they were lined up and shot and then burnt. And you could hear the screaming, and you could hear all this all through the neighborhood, and yet nobody did anything about it. Birkenau, of course, was the most intact camp when it was covered. I mean, I can remember my first trip there. My first trip there was in the early 70s, and that's before they had really cleansed the camp, for lack of a better word, had upgraded the camp. And I can remember going into Dr. Mengele's offices and just not even being able to conceive of what the medical experiments that he was doing right there. But you look at what you would consider to be an all-time classic camp and the entrance to the camp. Work will make you free. You're going to a work camp. You're not going to get killed. And then being shipped over to Birkenau, where you've got that classic structure, if you will. Birkenau gives you the perfect example of where they were. They weren't there to work. They weren't there to do anything. They were sent there to strip, walk into the showers, go into the crematorium, and you see all of this. And again, I know you've been there. You look at those ovens, and you can't conceive that they weren't baking bread in those ovens. They were baking human beings. And I mean, they were doing it 24 hours a day, shoveling them in one side and shoveling them out the other. And it's so emblematic of everything there is. Auschwitz was really the biggest camp. You know, the rail yards are right there. You can see everything. so well. And of course, the Nazis tried to destroy the camps as they were leaving them, but they weren't able to destroy that. I mean, so much of Eastern Europe is trying to forget that past, and they've sanitized so many of the camps, but they kept Auschwitz somewhat in check. I mean, you look at Elie Wiesel, the famous picture of Elie at Auschwitz. It was held together to be the symbol because it was such a perfect symbol of what the Nazis did to human beings. It's mind-boggling how these people can have absolutely no compunction, no compassion, no moral compass.
What I found so horrifying about the Nazis was how cold they were. They're just going about methodically wiping people out with no sense that they're people. It's just astonishing. I mean, there's something wrong with our society when we cannot protect people and give them a sense of safety against threats that clearly have to be suppressed. Look, I'm a conservative in part because I think safety comes from having people who are willing to stop evil. And if you're not willing to stop evil, you're opening up the innocent to being destroyed. It's very important when you think about the whole notion of never again. If we mean it, then we have to take action steps, not just emotional steps. And so I think that's why what you're doing is really important. I want to give you an opportunity for a minute. Tell people from your heart what you hope coming out of Remembrance Day, coming out of the museum, coming out of everything you've experienced in your life, what you hope they will take to their heart and that will lead them to the kind of actions that will give us a better and a safer world. I think it would be great, given all of your background and your remarkable experience.
My primary passion always, from the time that I was brought up in a little farm town in South Texas, and I'll never forget this, I was born in 1946, and of course all the Jews were merchants. And twice a year, they would pack coffin crates with clothes from their stores and whatever and ship them to Israel. And one night, about 10:30 at night, I was really tired. And I said to my father, you know, what are we doing this for? And he said, we have to do everything we can as a human being to preserve the state of Israel, to preserve Judaism, to preserve human rights. And I'll never forget standing on the floor of the Knesset making a speech and looking out that window and thinking back to being 10 years old and what I've accomplished. We are all brought up with American values. We are all brought up with Judeo-Christian values. It is incumbent on every one of us to go beyond ourselves, to go outside ourselves and preserve humanity. It's our job to educate every person we possibly can. We have a special obligation to make sure the rest of the world never forgets.
Next, the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and anti-Semitism today. Deborah's home was stolen. I don't mean thieves stole stuff. I mean scammers literally stole her home. The FBI calls home title theft one of the fastest growing white-collar crimes. This story is why you need Home Title Lock. Deborah says criminals found the title to our home online and filed fraudulent documents claiming they owned her home. Wait, it gets worse. Deborah says, I was evicted from my own home and $85,000 in equity. Gone. Nobody believes you can get your home stolen this easily. This is why you need to get Home Title Lock, because no insurance or bank protects your home from title theft. First things first. Go to HomeTitleLock.com and register your address to see if you're already a victim and don't know it. Then sign up to help protect the legal title to your home so you don't end up like Deborah. And to get you started, you'll receive 60 risk-free days of protection. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. That's HomeTitleLock.com. One of the amazing difficulties which all of us have to confront today, because we're doing the same thing they did in the 30s. We watch anti-Semitism in New York. We watch anti-Semitism in Paris. We watch anti-Semitism in Sweden. And we somehow shrug it off. And we don't want to come to grips with it. It's unpleasant. It's difficult. It requires us to have conversations that will embarrass some people, enrage others. Well, That's what happened in the late 30s. People didn't want to think about the good Germans going out here and attacking Jews, even though they had clear, visible evidence in 1938 that that's exactly what was starting to happen.
And the symbol of all of this, of course, was Auschwitz. And it's become the symbol to all of us of what can happen, what man is capable of doing to man. And we all think it could never happen again, but they certainly didn't think it could happen then. And it happened repeatedly. It happened in Muncie 3 weeks ago. I happened to be in Boca today. And when we flew in last night at the airport, there were an incredible number of Orthodox Jews that were at the airport coming in. And there's been a mass exodus just recently of Jews after the Muncie shooting and, you know, after the Pittsburgh shooting and the Poway shooting, of people moving to Florida where they feel it is much safer to be Jewish than it is walking the streets of Brooklyn and New York, where they're being attacked daily and killed again. And this is no different than what we went through before. Not only can it happen again, it is happening again. And we can never let our guard down. And we're seeing more of it, if you look at the statistics in the last year, than we ever have to protect our community going forward.
Well, listen, I really appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Auschwitz is something that we should always remember because it is a reminder of the evil that is possible. And in this case, of a particular evil, the evil of Nazi Germany, of an ideology dedicated to destroying an entire race simply for the act of being. The very act of living was unacceptable to Adolf Hitler and to his Nazi followers. And they were prepared to slaughter everybody, if that's what it took, in order to live out their truly warped and evil ideology. Callista, last year, as the ambassador to the Vatican, went to Auschwitz and participated in the International March of the Living, which is an annual event where particularly young people are brought and educated, and they then walk from Auschwitz to Birkenau, a remarkably short distance between two centers that are horrible. I would urge anybody who's listening to this, who has a chance to go to Poland to visit Auschwitz, that you should do so, because you'll never quite think about the Holocaust the same. You'll never quite think about the nature of evil the same. And it's a reminder that it can happen again, and that we have to take seriously the notion that we will not tolerate it. Thank you to my guest, Fred Zeidman, Chairman Emeritus of the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. You can read more about the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and anti-Semitism today on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Slum. Our editor is Robert Borowski, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. Our guest booker is Tamara Coleman. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvi. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's John Wardock and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, I'm going to talk about the Republican challenge in 2020. I think there's a great opportunity, but I think it requires a very different approach than Republicans are used to. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. The Westwood One Podcast Network.